Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is now off for the National Review cruise. Alexandra DeSanctis is in for Jim for the next 3 days. We're classing up the joint a little bit here while Jim is away. And I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And before we go any farther, Alexandra, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, let's start with our good martini, of course. And this is the brewing debate over disaster relief funding. It's obviously going to be coming given the immense devastation along the Texas Gulf Coast. And I would hazard to guess that probably be along the Louisiana Gulf Coast as well before all is said and done. And now with Ted Cruz and John Cornyn being in the mix here, they're being accused of hypocrisy because they did not like the way that the relief bill for the victims of Sandy was structured. They thought it was very laden with pork. And that has led to a couple of dust-ups with Senator Cruz. One was with CNN. The more famous one was with Katie Turr of MSNBC. This is about a minute long, but it's a good encapsulation of how this debate has played out here over the past couple days.
They're pointing at you and saying you're asking for money now when you weren't willing to help the people in the Northeast. What do you have to say to them?
Well, you know, look, there's time for political sniping later. I think our focus needs to be on this crisis and this disaster.
These are people who needed money and who needed funding right after that storm. I covered those people. Many of them, just like those in Houston, lost absolutely everything they owned.
The problem with that particular bill is it became a $50 billion bill that was filled with unrelated pork. Two-thirds of that bill had nothing to do with Sandy. And what I said then and still believe now is that it's not right for politicians to exploit a disaster and people are hurting to pay for their own political wish list. Disaster relief needs to be focused on the victims of disaster relief, and I supported that for Sandy, disaster relief there, and I would support that anywhere there's a major disaster without getting distracted by political unnecessary pork spending.
Now, Alexandra, National Review has reported on this. One of your colleagues has done the deep dive into some of the details about the Hurricane Sandy relief. Theodore Kupfer is his name, and he writes, "Understanding what actually happened when Congress provided disaster relief for Hurricane Sandy is the first step to understanding why this isn't the scandal some apparently think it to be. A month after Sandy hit New York and New Jersey in November 2012, the Obama administration requested $60 billion in appropriations for disaster relief. That request eventually passed in the form of the Disaster Relief Appropriations Act. Before it did, however, the Congressional Budget Office found that more than 60% of the funds included in the draft bill would not be spent until at least 2015, and it was described in the House bill as, quote, supplemental appropriations to improve and streamline disaster assistance for Hurricane Sandy, comma, and for other purposes." So, Alexandra, I don't think anybody's arguing that there doesn't need to be a massive federal assistance here in terms of the cleanup from Hurricane Harvey, but the revisionist history here seems to be something we need to address now and to make sure that we don't just keep dumping pork barrel after pork barrel into legislation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you that quote that you just read from the House bill, the "and for other purposes" seems to be the key clause. You know, what are those purposes? And Teddy in his piece goes on to list just a few of the choice things that were crammed into this Sandy bill, things like funding for fisheries in Alaska and New England, highway improvements across the entire country, some funds for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for weather forecasting purposes, $16 billion in a fund for any state that had experienced some kind of disaster in the previous 2 years leading up to Sandy, upgrading Amtrak lines, which were largely unaffected by the storm, you know, all these things that had literally nothing to do with Sandy. And apparently this disaster relief fund would pretty much go to every state. I think there are just three states that wouldn't have been able to draw on this relief fund for other disasters that they had experienced in the past 2 years. So, you know, the idea that Senator Cruz and Senator Cornyn were heartless and you know, didn't care about people in Sandy and now are coming back begging for government funding for their own state is ludicrous. What they didn't want was money going to fisheries in Alaska.
Yeah, I don't think fisheries in Alaska were hit directly by Hurricane Sandy. Just a hunch, although they may have their own issues. So, Alexandra, back in 2012 when this happened, obviously we had a Democratic president. The Democrats controlled the Senate and Republicans controlled the House. And ultimately, a lot of pork got through. Now, of course, Republicans control everything. So will we get another pork-laden bill, or will a more streamlined, targeted approach actually get through here?
I mean, one can hope. We can always hope that Republicans will do better than Democrats did in the past. But at this point, seeing some of the other shenanigans that have been going on in Congress, I'm not totally sure what to expect.
Oh, man. Yeah, probably right to be cynical at this point. But we'll see. A lot of different fiscal issues need to be addressed here soon. And that'll be one that wasn't originally on the agenda as soon as several days ago. But along with the debt ceiling and appropriations, we'll see just how fiscally responsible the GOP majorities can be. So let's move on to our bad martini now. And if you thought that maybe free speech was getting a little bit more welcome in some of the more liberal enclaves, well, it's a slow go. Nancy Pelosi's actually condemned the violence at Berkeley over the weekend, featuring Antifa folks beating up on people who we think were supportive of President Trump, although that anti-Marxism rally got canceled. But Alexandra, as you report in National Review Online, Berkeley once again in the crosshairs, and it is not distinguishing itself as big fans of the First Amendment. I'll read a little bit from your piece here. The mayor of Berkeley is urging the University of California, Berkeley, to cancel an upcoming appearance by controversial right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos, citing his concerns that anti-fascists will use large protests to create mayhem. Quote, "I'm very concerned about Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter and some of these other right-wing speakers coming to the Berkeley campus," Mayor Jesse Aragon told the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday. "It's just a target for the Black Bloc, Antifa, to come out and commit mayhem on the Berkeley campus and have that potentially spill out on the street," unquote. Back to you. But don't try to tell Aragon that his suggestion might in fact be an infringement on free speech rights. Quote, "I obviously believe in freedom of speech, but there is a line between freedom of speech and then posing a risk to public safety," he added. So the solution here, Alexander, is apparently not to put the restraints on Antifa and do what you need to do to prevent violence and chaos and anarchy from breaking out in the streets, but it's to suppress conservative speech. So clearly he's on the right track here.
He's essentially endorsing the heckler's veto here is what he's doing. You know, whoever can gather the biggest mob and break enough windows is the person who gets to decide what we talk about in public forums. And not only that, but on a university campus. You know, he went on to say, "We have to be careful that while protecting free speech rights, we're not putting our citizens in a potentially dangerous situation and costing the city hundreds of thousands of dollars fixing the windows of businesses." So, you know, if a crowd just happens to turn up and, you know, yells loud enough, then no one's allowed to speak or say something unpopular or say something that might happen to irritate the biggest group of liberals in the city. You know, this is ridiculous. And the mayor is pretty much talking about this as if he has no control over the law enforcement in this city. You know, I'm not sure exactly the chain of command in Berkeley, but it's not like he's some random guy on the street. He's the mayor. So if he's worried about violence, he could go to the police department or go to a city council and say, "Look, we need to deploy every resource that we have in tamping down this kind of violence, making it clear that this is not going to be tolerated. We want to have a community where free speech can flourish, not where we feel like we have to send certain speakers packing, and always right-wing speakers, to be honest, because it's so liberal and people are just going to get in the town square and yell and break things."
Yeah, conservatives don't yell and break things. So liberal speakers are fine to come to campus, but conservatives are not. And of course, you probably ought to know the response that'll be required, given what happened with the scheduled Milo Yiannopoulos speech from a number of months ago. But, you know, he mentioned Yiannopoulos, he mentioned Coulter. Obviously, they're controversial speakers. But then Berkeley is also, I think, requiring the college Republicans there to pony up tens of thousands of dollars for security when Ben Shapiro goes there. And Ben, of course, writes for National Review now and again. So, I mean, where does the slippery slope end here? Are we going to get to the point where, you know, Republican elected officials or anybody that's going to draw a radical reaction from Antifa is now considered too controversial?
it seems to be getting to that point. And the fact of the matter is, if they're given this heckler's veto by the mayor, I'm sure they'll get, people on the left are going to get even bolder and think, if I'm loud enough, I basically get to decide who speaks on campus and who doesn't. And they're going to take advantage of that.
Unbelievable. The slippery slope alive and well, and heckler's veto is exactly what's going on here. They're not bold enough to actually confront the people causing the mayhem, so they're going to pretend the problem is something else. All right, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And Alexandra, Jim and I just talked yesterday about how the media was spending a lot of time in recent days coming to the absolute didactic conclusion that climate change was the reason that Hurricane Harvey was so horrible. The media is back in the crazy martini for the second consecutive day, and it may well be for an even crazier reason. Yesterday is when President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump went to Texas, Corpus Christi, as well as Austin, to meet with officials there, get a firsthand look at the disaster response with this horrific record-setting flooding. 50 inches of rain, just unfathomable. But is the media looking at the federal response? Is it looking at the coordinated response among all levels? No. The fashion of the First Lady is what had everybody all aghast on Twitter and even in the mainstream press yesterday, because Melania Trump wore high heels from the White House to the chopper to take them to Andrews Air Force Base, and then she wore them onto Air Force One. And while they were in the air, the Twitter sphere just absolutely erupted. Everyone's retweeting stuff. Everybody's horrified. But even the New York Times and the Washington Post are getting in on this and deciding what larger themes it all represents here. Here's the New York Times. When is a shoe not just a shoe? When it is a pair of very high, needle-thin heels worn by the First Lady of the United States on her way to the site of a natural disaster. Then it becomes a symbol for what many see, read that as the New York Times newsroom, as the disconnect between the Trump administration and reality. Another example of the way in which this president and his family continue to define appropriate their own way and an excuse for partisan name-calling. If you thought that was bad, here's the Washington Post. This is just not just suggesting that they're out of touch. It's even worse. Melania Trump is the kind of woman who travels to a flood-ravaged state in a pair of black snakeskin stilettos. Heels this high are not practical, but Trump is not the kind of woman who has to be practical. Heels this high are not comfortable. Comfortable is not the point, neither hers nor yours. Trump is the kind of woman who refuses to pretend that her feet will at any point ever be immersed in cold, muddy, bacteria-infested Texas water. She is the kind of woman who may listen empathetically to your pain, but she knows that you know that she is not going to experience it. So why pretend? Heading off to Texas, she looked dressed to view a natural disaster from a distance, from on high, not up close. Her ensemble implied that people's personal stories would be ferried to her after they had been vetted and tidied up. Alexandra, it's not often we've got a female perspective here on the Three Martini Lunch, but it just so happens it's perfect for this particular crazy martini today. What do you make of the media and other people on social media, of course, going apoplectic about Melania Trump's footwear while en route?
Well, I mean, the first thing that struck me was the fact that everybody had this sort of idea that everybody puts on one pair of shoes in the morning and then they're kind of glued to your feet and there's no way you can take them off for the rest of the day. You know, the idea that she could possibly change shoes into something more appropriate once she got to Texas never even crossed these people's minds, you know, like, and she did in fact change her shoes. She put on a pair of sneakers and, you know, even if she hadn't, I don't know what the big fuss is, but it's not as though she got up in the morning and said, this is it. You know, I'm signed on for the day. Can't possibly change my wardrobe. Okay. So first of all that, but second of all, what really struck me is just the immense double standard on the left, and especially among, you know, sort of feminist type women, because something very similar happened with Ivanka Trump a couple of months ago at the G20 summit. Joan Walsh and others were critiquing her for wearing some kind of pink business dress and saying, this is girly, it's not made for work, it's not made to go out in the world and make a difference, things like this. And so both Melania and Ivanka are subjected to this extremely rigorous vetting of their wardrobe. Meanwhile, people on the left, women on the left, are praised for trying to free themselves from these restrictive rules. You know, in the House gallery has a rule that women have to wear sleeves. They can't wear sleeveless dresses in the House. And the Democratic congresswomen and people on the left were up in arms about this, saying, you know, what is it's 2017? How come women can't express themselves? On and on and on. And it just makes me think, you know, if Michelle Obama had walked out to Air Force One in stilettos heading down to Texas, I'm 100% sure that the headlines would have been something like, Michelle's going to take down Hurricane Harvey and doing it in heels, no less. There's a powerful woman. But nope, not for Melania. Instead, Melania is looking down from on high because she happens to wear high heels.
So when you look at especially modern feminists, but even maybe feminists in general, it really does, whether you look at the Clinton impeachment scandal or anything else along the way, it really just does boil down to your politics and ultimately pretty much where you stand on abortion, right?
Yeah, sure. It's not about the shoes at all. It's about who's wearing them and whether or not we like that woman.
Well, on that depressing note, especially when it comes to equality that the feminists claim to be promoting so much, Alexandra, fantastic job today. We look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review in for Jim Garrity today and for the rest of this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Don't forget, as we mentioned on Tuesday, that next week the Three Martini Lunch will be on vacation. We'll be here the rest of this week on vacation next week, and then Jim and I will be back on Monday, September the 11th. Thanks for being with us today, and please tune in again on Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.